Does the agricultural biotechnology company Monsanto live up to its own self-profile as improving the lives of farmers by making them more productive with fewer resources? Or is their true relationship with farmers more based on bullying and intimidation? And how did Monsanto and the other biotech companies come into existence in the first place? Do they have an agenda beyond making agriculture more efficient and sustainable? On today's show, Percy Schmeiser, the legendary Saskatchewan farmer who stood up to Monsanto for years in court, will join us to talk about his long battle with the company and the experiences his fellow farmers have had with this firm. We will also hear a rebroadcast of our May interview with author and geopolitical analyst William Engdahl about the hidden background outlying the real motivations behind the GMO movement. On today's show, Monsanto, partners in sustainability or global racketeers? Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 11th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. You can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. The swift move to level Sandy Hook arguably has precedence established in momentous terror-related incidents. On May 24, 1995, just 35 days after the 1995 bombing of the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City, the U.S. government moved to have the structure demolished before a proper investigation could be conducted on the structure's remains. A similar set of circumstances played out in the aftermath of the September 11, 2001 attacks as New York municipal authorities arranged for the remaining steel from the World Trade Center towers to be shipped to China and India. 9/11 victims' families and independent experts say such materials would have aided in understanding what actually took place on that fateful day. That's from the Sandy Hook School Massacre. School building is now slated for demolition. Why? By James Tracy, posted October 9th. On October 2nd, Israel's Channel 2 TV News said senior Israeli security officials met with a high-level Gulf state counterpart, it's believed to be Saudi Prince Bandar bin Sultan. He came to discuss interests both countries share. They include toppling Assad and confronting Iran. Pursuing this agenda risks embroiling the entire region in conflict. That's from the Israeli-Saudi Arabia, an unholy alliance by Stephen Lendman, posted October 10th. Yesterday, Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee said, "We have martial law, and my colleagues know what it means." The last time we heard Congress members use the phrase martial law was when Congressman Brad Sherman and Paul Kanjorski and Senator James Inhofe all said that Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson warned of martial law if the TARP bank's bailouts weren't approved. That's from Congress Member Says We Have Martial Law by Washington's blog, posted October 9th. The crucial aspect of this operation is the message sent to the people of the world. The message is about the change of core principles of the global economy. Any chance change in the global financial system is useless without a proper change of the underlying ideology. For the BRICS to prevail, the professionals working on spreading the right message have to perform brilliantly. The world must see that the whole struggle is not about hijacking the current economic system, but it is about creating an equitable economic system. That's from the BRICS versus the US dollar, what will happen to the global economy if BRICS announce launch of new currency by Peter Koenig, posted October 9th. Economist Dr. Paul Craig Roberts contends the situation is unsustainable. It will blow up at some point, and Dr. Roberts predicts, quote, it will be worse than the Great Depression because in the Great Depression, prices fell along with employment. Now prices will be rising and employment would be falling. Gold and silver prices will explode in dollar terms, unquote. That's Paul Craig Roberts. Worse than the Great Depression, gold and silver prices will explode. The situation is unsustainable. From an interview with a USA Watchdog posted October 10th. At the 12th anniversary of 9/11, RT's popular program, The Truth Seeker, ran a 13-minute episode, 9/11 and Operation Gladio, presenting new historical evidence that began to go viral. This RT episode, seen on YouTube by 250,000 people in its first 3 days, suddenly flatlined September 11th when viewing virtually stopped. A careful analysis follows, showing that the RT title and URL were decoupled from the YouTube and Google indexes and could not be transmitted by email during the weeks that followed. Did RT change the YouTube privacy setting because of political pressure? Or was there covert search engine interference? As from the article, Do Google and YouTube Search Engines Block Inconvenient Truth? A Case Study by Global Research News, posted October 9th, originally published in PR Newswire, US Newswire. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Company Monsanto is a seed company, an agricultural biotechnology company that claims to be committed to sustainable agriculture and producing more food while conserving soil and water and improving the lives of farmers. Yet, the company has triggered a worldwide movement in opposition to them. Saturday, October 12th, is a day of action in which people in over 500 locations around the world will publicly condemn the company and its practices. To better understand the concerns underlying these protests, we talked to someone who has become one of the world's best-known Monsanto antagonists. Percy Schmeiser farms near Bruno, Saskatchewan. Percy Schmeiser famously was the figure at the center of a very long legal battle with the biotechnology company Monsanto. At stake were the rights of farmers and the future of seeds. So to tell us of his David and Goliath battle is the man himself, Percy Schmeiser. Thank you very much for joining us, Percy.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you this afternoon, and also it's a real pleasure because we have a beautiful, warm Saskatchewan day, which farmers are really looking forward to because we still have a lot of harvesting to be done in our area. So a few extra days would mean a lot.
Okay. Now, you actually ended up winning an award, the Right Livelihood Award, for fighting to defend the rights of farmers. I want just, you know, for just to give us a sort of a good overview, could you maybe just share with us briefly yet again the circumstances by which you came into conflict with Monsanto?
Well, okay.
In 1997?
Quite quickly is that in GMOs came out, were introduced in both countries, U.S. and Canada, in 1996. Four crops introduced at that time, which was corn, cotton, soya, and especially here in Canada, canola. And so that was in 1996. And in 1998, my wife and I, which we were known as seed developers in canola, we were contaminated in 1998, and that was when Monsanto laid what they call a patent infringement lawsuit against us because we were using our own seed from year to year in development, and because of the contamination, they said we violated their patent. So basically, that was the case, a patent infringement case. And so we stood up to Monsanto on this, and it went through a federal court, which patent laws come under, then federal court of appeal, which we were successful in them hearing it. And then after that, it went all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada. And so there were a lot of issues then that had arisen by that time, because it took about 4 to 5 years or 6 years to get to the Supreme Court of Canada. And basically, it hinged on the rights of farmers versus how much control the corporations or anyone that has a patent on higher life forms, how far can you go with it. So it became a very important case and was the first case in the world in regards to the patents of higher life forms. So that's basically what the case was all about. And in the end, what happened was that we didn't have to pay Monsanto any money. We won our case against Monsanto, but we had challenged Monsanto in the Supreme Court that rights to life or higher life forms should not be patented. And on that, Monsanto Supreme Court sided with Monsanto on it, but it was a split decision, 5-4. But there were other cases that Monsanto had laid against us in those years before it went all the way to Supreme Court, and I think I should mention some of them. And this can happen to many other farmers, and has happened to many other farmers in both U.S. and Canada. First of all, during the course of the trial, especially after the Court of Appeal, Monsanto laid a $1 million lawsuit against us because we stood up to them, and they wanted all their legal expense paid up to a certain point in time. And so we had to fight that lawsuit, $1 million. And it was very interesting, some of the expenses they had claimed. The other lawsuit they laid against us is that they issued liens and caveats against us, my wife and myself. They tried to seize our home. They tried to seize all our farmland. They tried to seize all our farm equipment. So we had to fight that. So those were all before the Supreme Court of Canada. And so at the Supreme Court, as I said, we were successful that we won our case against Monsanto. But what was not fair, and we still maintain that to this day, Monsanto had to pay their legal bill, and we had to pay our legal bill. And Monsanto laid the lawsuits against us, and being that they lost, they should have had to pay all our legal bill also, but that didn't happen. But so anyway, that gives you a brief explanation of the different lawsuits that we went through.
Mm. Now, I know that there was also a situation where Monsanto had forced you're talking about Monsanto forcing you to sign a release saying that you could never take them to court again?
That's right. That was one of the, that was another actually, after the Supreme Court cases, we thought we were done with Monsanto. And several years afterwards, we thought, well, my wife had asked me never to grow, and she was the main developer ever to grow canola again, but she still liked to carry on the research, and so we decided to do this with yellow mustard. And here, after we were getting one of our fields, a 50-acre research field ready, we found it was contaminated with canola. And doing testing, we were quite sure that it was Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola. And we had sprayed some canola, of their herbicide Roundup on 12 plants. They were stake marked, and they didn't die. And we had notified Monsanto that we felt that we had some of their contamination again, and we'd like them to come out and check it. And indeed, within 2 days, they were here with two people, and they checked that 50-acre field. There were plants intermittently through the fields, individual plants and clumps of plants. And we got a sample from each plant. They got a sample. 2 days later, they notified us, yes, indeed, those canola plants that were in our field were Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola plants. And they asked us what we wanted, especially my wife, what we wanted to have done with it. And she said to them, because it was a research field, she wanted every plant pulled out by hand, so none of the seeds from those plants. It was almost in the seed stage. And they agreed to do that. Mm. And several days before they were to come, we get a fax from Monsanto, and they said that before they removed the plants, we would have to sign a release statement. First of all, that we could never, ever take Monsanto to court again for the rest of our lives, and that we could not talk to anyone. In fact, our freedom of speech would be taken away. So we notified Monsanto back then. We said we'd never give up our freedom of speech. They contaminated, you contaminated our field, and so we would not sign that document to give our rights of freedom of speech and not to be able to ever take them. In fact, they said that our anyone of our family, like my wife, myself, our children, would never, ever be able to take Monsanto to court again for the rest of our lives, and we disagreed with that. Monsanto fired back and said, if we don't sign the release agreement, like other farmers, they get other farmers to do, they won't remove the plants. So we notified Monsanto, said, it's your contamination. We went them off our land, and we're going to do with them what we want. We will remove them. And Monsanto fired back, and that's when it really got nasty. And he said, those plants on your field are not your property. You're not allowed to do with them what you want, and unless you sign the agreement. And so what happened was that we did not sign the agreement. And with the help of our neighbors, we removed the plants. And we notified Monsanto that the days it would be done, because it took about 3 days with the help of our neighbors. And we notified Monsanto it had been done. And then we notified Monsanto, what do you want done with those plants? And they said that unless you sign those documents, you can't do with it what you want. And they said, and that in other words, they had said their property, and then we said to them, we pay the taxes, we own the land, we're going to do with it whatever we want on our own land. So in the end, we had burnt what we had taken off our land, and then we sent Monsanto the bill. Monsanto refused the bill unless we signed the release forms and the gag
order. How much was the bill for?
Pardon?
What was the bill?
Oh, the bill was very small. We paid our neighbors $640 and nothing for our own labor and one of my hired men's labor. So it was basically really nothing. My neighbors were really good on this. And so we sent Monsanto the bill. They refused to pay it. And this went on for about a year. And finally, we took Monsanto to small claims court. The judge agreed to hear it. And so we had Monsanto, a $1 billion corporation, in court on a $640 bill. In the end, Monsanto paid for the contamination cleanup. To us, it was not the issue of the $640. The whole issue of farmers' rights, and where a corporation come in, contaminate your land, then want to take your rights of freedom of speech away, your rights to never be able to take them to court again for the rest of your life, we thought that's just going a little bit too far. And we thought it was a major victory because there's a precedent has been set, an avenue has been opened that if farmers are contaminated, there is a way to protect yourself. But on the other hand, having said that, it costs, you probably could cost thousands of dollars, because Monsanto will fight you every inch of the way to try and stop you. And that's what they have done to many, many farmers, that they, through taking or standing up to a farmer in court, it cost the farmer a lot, not only money, but his time. So, but anyway, an avenue has been set. If you can contaminate and you own the patent, you should pay for the damage, and it becomes also a liability issue.
It seems as if you have, or if Monsanto apparently has the right to patent life, to patent a seed, what does that say to the rights of farmers who wish to be acknowledged as organic farmers and not have to, like, because these seeds they could just blow into your field, right? So like what rights do you have to maintain your acknowledged as free from GMOs and to farm organically?
Well, this is something that's really, really not right in our country of Canada, that if you are an organic farmer, conventional farmer, and you are contaminated under patent law, you no longer own your seeds or plants, and you no longer can use your seeds or plants from year to year like we were doing. So basically, your freedom of choice and your freedom of to grow and develop the seeds you want and your loss of biodiversity, this all is lost. And so that this, because you have a patent on a life form, it's under the patent laws as they stand now, you have control of that life form. So how far do you go? The question is now being asked. Seeds, plants, birds, bees, animals, fish, and what about even human beings? And these are things that my case has all brought forward and has to be addressed sooner or later in regards. Now, in gave you what has happened in Europe, if you are contaminated, you have a right to go after the company. You don't lose your rights to your seeds or plants. So they are way ahead of us into protection of farmers' rights compared to us here in Canada. We basically, a farmer has lost his rights.
Could you talk about, because you've been, I know you have a number of speaking engagements over the next little while, and you've spoken around the world. Have you ever been in touch, has Monsanto approached you while you've been at these various locations? What kind of encounters have you had with Monsanto?
Some of the encounters were on a business level, but most of them were not. They were threats, like many farmers that have received threats. We were threatened by one of Monsanto's reps at one of the meetings where, and this was at in the legislature of a country. In fact, it was South Africa, and one of Monsanto's reps said to my wife and myself, he shook his fist, my wife's face, my face, and said, "No one stands up to Monsanto. We're going to get both of you somehow, someday, and we're going to destroy you." And that's what makes that we refer to now as that whole new culture of fear. Farmers are just scared because the power that these corporations have now over through patent laws. And so it has not been easy for us. They would watch, especially, it was not easy for my wife. They would come into our driveway, watch what she would be doing all day long, or they would sit on the road alongside of our farms and watch what my men were doing and what I was doing. So it was pretty scary at times. So, but that, so you can imagine that how farmers feel when they heard it, when they go to my neighbors and say, "If you support Percy and Louise Schmeiser, we're going to come after you and you won't have a farm left." We didn't think this ever could happen to a first world country like Canada, but it's happening to hundreds and hundreds of people. The letters, the phone calls that we have received, and how many farmers have just given up, caved into Monsanto and given up their freedom of speech because if a farmer agrees not to talk about it, they'll get off with a lesser fine. Maybe instead of paying $200 acre farm, they might get off for $100 an acre farm or whatever. So it's cost farmers thousands and thousands of dollars, and they're not allowed to talk about it.
Do you understand the allure for some farmers? I mean, why is it that among your neighbors that they are getting into this contract with Monsanto? Is it the fear factor, or is there any particular carrot, if you will, that's attracting
well,
people?
I would say to answer that is at the beginning, farmers didn't know. They believed what they were told by the companies, especially Monsanto: increased yields, less chemicals, more nutritious. We'd now be able to feed a hungry and starving world. It's more nutritious. And that was one of the reasons. But once you grew it, you were trapped. You're trapped because Monsanto knows that if you ever grow a certain variety of canola, you're going to have seeds, and a lot of them seeds can lie dormant for 20 years. And it's, if you decide to go to a different variety, like you want it to become organic, or you want to be back to conventional seed, they know that there will be contamination in there, and it doesn't matter what the level of contamination is. And that's one thing what was done in my case. Level of contamination doesn't matter. If it's even half of 1% contamination, you violate their patent. So if it's 1% or 2%, it's over. So once you got it, you're basically trapped. And Monsanto knew that all they had to do is get a farmer talked into it, and then be very difficult for him to go to any other variety. I should mention that a thing that Monsanto first was saying in Europe, when I was talking a lot in Europe, and especially Germany, And Monsanto's reps there at one meeting said I had about 98% of my contamination was Monsanto's GMOs. But what, and 98%, well, even if you bought seed from Monsanto, you'd very unlikely to have a highest percentage like that, 98%. But what they were very misleading is that the my contamination, and I had this done by two scientists from the University of Manitoba at Winnipeg, checked my contamination, and it varied all the way from two quarters of land, 0% to 1%, 8%, and in the ditch next to my neighbor in the ditch, it was around 60-some percent. But what Monsanto, when they say it was 98%, whose GMOs were in our field? What company was it? 98% of that 2% or 5% was Monsanto's GMOs. So the biggest contamination came from Monsanto, and that's where they try and mislead and tell people that I had such a high rate of contamination, but it was the variety of the contamination, which was Monsanto, was 98%. So Monsanto could easily be held totally liable for the damages or liability.
Do you see this any kind of a light on the horizon or a light at the end of this dark tunnel for farmers? Is it possible for Monsanto to be at least contained, if not
Well, I think what is happening is that at the beginning, a lot of the consumers thought it was only a problem for farmers. But now consumers are really becoming concerned of what is in our food now. And so a lot of them want to know, they want labeling, they want to know. And that's what has happened in Europe, is that they have labeling, and so they refuse to buy GMOs. To give an example, Monsanto, about a month ago, pulled out of Europe now, because people will not buy genetic altered foods because they know the dangers of the new virus, the new bacteria, the new antibiotic resistant marker gene, especially in canola, and they don't want to have this new virus, this new bacteria in their food. And that's what we have here. And so people don't know what's in their food. And I think that's the biggest light at the end of the tunnel, is that people are becoming more aware in both our countries, U.S. and Canada, of the danger of eating genetic altered food, and people should have that right. To me, your freedoms of choice are being taken away by not being that you don't know what's in your food. Everyone should have that right, and to me, I think it's absolutely criminal that we don't have that right in Canada. Our basic, as I say, our basic freedoms of choice is being taken away, and that people should have that choice or that freedom to know what's in their food. And I think that is the biggest light at the end of the tunnel, is that people are becoming, the consumers are now becoming aware that they want to know what's in their food, what they're feeding to their children and grandchildren. One of the main reasons that that I have kept on is to bring this awareness to people. There's a lot of information out on the internet. There's a lot of information from Europe, where a lot of studies have been done on the effects of eating GMO food. Even Russia has a lot of information on the effects of on mice and rats. And so people are really becoming concerned. And this is why I think the Canadian Food Inspection Agency should play a bigger role in doing some of this testing, instead of taking just the testing that's been done by corporations and given to them, and they only use that. They should do the testing themselves and not rely on a corporation to supply them the testing. So that's why, to me, my wife and I will continue to bring this awareness. And I said, then people can make the choice, but they should be able to have that choice to make.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Percy Schmeiser, for filling us in on these very important details.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope that people take more of an interest, and because we still can do something yet now, because we've often said, once you introduce it, we don't know, and I've asked many scientists around the world about this. They don't know, once you introduce it, if you ever can bring it back out of the environment. And that's why it's so important that the choices we make will not only affect us today, but for many generations to come. So again, thank you very much for having me.
Percy Schmeiser farms near Bruno, Saskatchewan, the figure at the center of a long legal battle with the company Monsanto. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. We welcome our new partner, CHLY 101.7 Radio Malaspina Society, broadcasting out of Nanaimo, BC on the West Coast. The Global Research News Hour broadcasts on CHLY every Thursday starting at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Joining us now to discuss the question of genetic modification and provide us a little bit of background on that technology and on the company Monsanto is geopolitical analyst, author, and economist William Engdahl. He is the author of Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation. So thank you for joining us, William Engdahl.
Thank you.
Now, I read your book, I find that it seems as if the whole issue of genetic engineering, it seems like it's not unlike water fluoridation and the chemical, the use of chemical pesticides and herbicides, this idea of a solution looking for a problem. That's developed during wartime. Could you maybe help our listeners understand a little bit about how genetic engineering came to be as an element of our agricultural reality?
Well, the GMO project was started by the Rockefeller Foundation, the same people who created the world cartel in oil multinationals, the first real multinationals, I suppose, if you want to look at it that way. And after World War II, Nelson Rockefeller, one of the brothers, went with Norman Borlaug, who was working for the Rockefeller University at the time as a researcher, to Mexico and South America, where the Rockefeller family had huge oil and other interests. And he had the idea to introduce wheat hybrids, so-called miracle wheat, into agriculture in Mexico and other developing countries with an eye to industrialization of the agriculture there, similar to what was going on in the American agriculture north of the Rio Grande. And the Rockefeller Foundation financed a project called Agribusiness at Harvard Business School in the 1950s. Now, what does this have to do with patenting seeds and genetically modifying plants? Well, I think it has everything to do, if you look at it as an historical process, because the idea of creating a top-down vertical integration, a monopoly concentration in food production in the same way that the Rockefeller Standard Oil Group had done with oil production was their dream. That was essentially the raison d'etre behind the agribusiness project at Harvard Business School. And precisely to create vertical integration where the actual physical farmer and the farm family, the family farm, would be the least relevant or important link in this whole chain, and the concentration would concentrate profits in for-profit-only stock companies like Conagra or Tyson Foods or such concentrates. And one of these is Monsanto, one of the core companies of the Rockefeller family holdings. So the idea of genetically manipulating, inserting a foreign bacteria or fungus into the genome or the DNA of a plant or of an animal or of a human, for that matter, is what they're trying now. This comes out of something called eugenics. And for people who don't know what eugenics is, it's the Nazi race science, the attempts by the Nazi doctors during the 1930s and into World War II to literally breed a master race through manipulating genes and eliminate the undesirable races, the so-called inferiors. And the eugenics projects of the Hitler Third Reich at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute in Berlin and Munich and elsewhere, Dr. Mengele, the doctor of death as he's known in history, Joseph Mengele and others, this was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation. And they were quite open about it at the time. I mean, they didn't try to hide it. They do now, but it's too late because the archives have been researched thoroughly. after World War II, they had a conference. One of the prime sponsors of the American Eugenics Society was the Rockefeller family, the Rockefeller brothers, and the Rockefeller Foundation, financial sponsors. They held a conference. Someone close to the Rockefeller family was the president of the American Eugenics Society, and he said after World War II and the discovery of the Nuremberg and the Auschwitz gas ovens and so forth, the new name of eugenics will be genetics. And I think that says it all. So the idea of being able to tinker with life, to be able to play around with the DNA structure and modify it in some way, is a mad dream of a group of scientists sponsored by Rockefellers, and has been for decades, since probably before the end of World War II. And it's doomed to fail because you cannot manipulate life in that manner. It's based on scientific reductivism, and reductivism is simply false science, trying to force everything into the smallest imaginable glob of matter, a single gene, and claim that defines its characteristics. Well, genes, like human beings, are defined by their social environment, by their by the universe that they live in, not only by their own individual expression, and that's the fundamental flaw of GMO.
Yeah, obviously, I don't think too many people are very aware of that insidious background to this technology. In fact, the technology itself, it's not very well promoted, even though the people who develop it and try to promote it, it's not something that's promoted on the product itself, certainly not they're trying to discourage labeling of genetically modification, you know, so... I guess the question is then that who principally benefits from genetic modification? I mean, even in terms of who they're trying to direct this technology to, I mean, it's...
Well, I'm gonna give a little bit of a shocking own conclusion on this. People who are interested in a detailed explanation of it should get the book and read it. Not simply because I wrote the book, but it's the only place I know of where it's the case is laid out in such detailed form. But the labeling was put in place under George Father Bush in 1992. In a private meeting in the White House with the heads of Monsanto, the largest owner of patented seeds and the largest commercial seed owner in the world today. They've been buying up independent heritage seed companies wherever they can so that they can get this monopoly. And the goal, in my view, is to, well, it goes back to a quote from Henry Kissinger attributed to him during the 1970s when we had an oil crisis and a food crisis. And Kissinger at that time said, "If you control the food, you control the people." And I think that's precisely what certain powerful elite circles are trying to do with patenting of seeds, of GMO seeds. If you control the patents on rice seeds that are grown in China or Asia, and soybean seeds and corn seeds that are one of the main crops in U.S. agriculture, and certainly... the main source of animal feed in the world today in the commercial agriculture, if you control the patents on those, you have the potential to control entire governments, like what Kissinger imposed on Chile during the Allende regime. He imposed, if food is a weapon, he cut off USAID food supplies that led to growing popular demonstrations against Allende that gave the cover for the military coup that Kissinger wanted in Chile.
Mr. Engdahl, I just want, sorry to interrupt, but I just remember at the outset you were talking about the Rockefellers and oil, and I seem to recall that the Marshall Plan, I mean, one of the effects of that, whether it was intended or not, is it shifted the base of industrial production away from coal to oil, correct? In Europe?
Well, yeah. Europe after the... World War II, Europe was a predominantly coal-driven economy, and what happened is that the Marshall Plan was used to, in large part, transform agriculture, mechanized agriculture with tractors and so forth, using Rockefeller Standard Oil. They got the lion's share of the oil markets across Europe after the war, and transform Europe's economy from coal to petroleum, which was the Rockefeller game.
And as I think you were saying, that it seems as if this transformation, like what they did for oil, now they're wanting to do for food production. So it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah. If they control the seeds, they can deny the seeds. The seeds are licensed. You sign an agreement with Monsanto. Let's take them as a example, because they're the biggest. And in that agreement, you have to agree only to use Monsanto seeds that you buy each planting season from Monsanto anew, and you have to use a Monsanto patented Roundup weed killer. Now, Roundup, Monsanto refuses to release the list of ingredients in Roundup other than to say it's based on glyphosate, which is a highly toxic herbicide to begin with. But what they've done is add various adjuvants to the glyphosate that make it one of the most toxic brews cocktails out there. And there have been tests by scientists at Caen University in France under Gilles-Éric Seralini and his team that have tested the effects of Monsanto Roundup in doses less than what you have in your garden. Roundup is the most widely sold weed killer in the world today. And in doses less than are common in the garden, it kills cells in a human embryo. So that's pretty scary stuff. And that is tied in with the purchase of Monsanto seeds. And now what Monsanto is doing is a terror campaign, I think you have to call it, across the United States, that farmers who have a field next to a Monsanto GMO field, and the wind carries some of the seeds from the GMO field over into the non-GMO field, Monsanto will send private detectives around, kind of bounty hunters, to make crop tests of the neighboring farm. And if they find evidence of GMO, then they'll sue that farmer for stealing Monsanto seeds when the wind is what brought it over. And they knowingly do this in order to terrorize farmers into accepting GMO seeds.
Now, the technology, that there has been scientific research that's been conducted that attests to the hazards of this technology, if I'm not mistaken. Yet that has not done much to discourage this enterprise. Are we talking about a similar phenomenon to the way the tobacco industry has been able to suppress research pointing to its harmful impacts on human health?
Well, it's similar, but let's take it directly for what has happened. Monsanto has refused, for any independent test, they've refused to make their GMO seeds available to laboratories anywhere in the world. And that's even been the subject of a critical editorial in the American Science magazine, but the Scientific American. But the finally, in September 2012, in Food and Chemical Toxicology, and keep in mind the name of the journal, Toxicology, and a very respected scientific trade journal, they released a study by scientists in France, led by Professor Seralini, and the study was immediately posted on the internet to outflank Monsanto and their agri-lobby, and they did the world's first ever two-year-long feeding study, long-term study, with 200 rats on a diet with control groups and non-control, a diet of GMO corn. And what they found, and this was all peer-reviewed, and it was scientifically completely rigorous, and what they found was absolutely alarming. It should have killed the licensing of GMO for once and for all, pending repetition of the Seralini study by other independent scientists. Rats developed tumors, not after 90 days, which is the longest studies that Monsanto ever did on any of its GMO crops, but in some cases after 4 months or 8 or 9 months. But they developed horrendous rates, of tumors, cancer tumors. They developed organ damage. They developed unbelievable death rate on the rats that were fed GMO were something like 2 to 5 times higher than non-GMO rats. So all of the indications pointed a flashing red light. Let's make a full stop here on further licensing of GMO from the Food and Agriculture FDA in the United States or the USDA, and really examine this, have a moratorium on it, and examine in great detail what the long-term effects are in over a two-year period. Well, instead of that being done, the European Commission in Brussels, which is a body whose middle name is corruption, I would venture to say today, the European Commission in Brussels, which is the kind of the administrative non-elected heart of the European Union, they dutifully gave it to the European Food Safety Administration, so-called experts, and 6 of the members of the EFSA panel that were supposed to review Seralini's study are members of front groups financed by Monsanto and the agribusiness GMO lobby. And what they did was issued after a few days, few weeks, they issued a statement dismissing entirely the Seralini study, saying it's not biologically meaningful and therefore does not require further testing. Well, talk about a non-brainer. If this one study they claimed has scientific flaws, and they fail to enumerate the flaws in their report, well, then out of pure concern for human health and safety, they should have immediately said the European Union should finance several independent studies using the same parameters to confirm or disconfirm. Rather than that, they said let's close the case on this. Everything's okay. So this is an indication of the kind of corruption that Monsanto and related GMO organizations spent. I've seen reports of over $100 million on the stopping the California labeling referendum some months back in the U.S. So this resembles more an organization of some kind of mafia than it does an honorable, serious company trying to improve the food supply for the world's population, which is their PR pitch, by the way.
So why did certain countries, especially Argentina, came to become major hubs for this new technology? Could you describe how Argentina, just for starters, came to be a major developer of this of soybeans, for example?
Well, in the early 90s, Argentina was in the midst of a grave debt crisis, the late 80s, early 90s. Carlos Menem was president. Carlos Menem, a personal family friend of David Rockefeller and the Bush family, both often guest at their homes, respectively. The Menem government gave Monsanto the exclusive, without any kind of congressional hearings or a debate or anything, made an agreement with Monsanto as the exclusive purveyor of GMO soybean seeds. At that time, Argentina was one of 3 large soybean growing areas in the world, the other being Brazil and the United States, North America, United States. And so with that, within a matter of a few years, soybeans took over Argentine agriculture, and soybeans grown by very large landowners, this medieval Spanish latifundista model, where you drive peasants off their land, you come in and use police to terrorize peasant families that have worked the land for generations, and bring in agribusiness and mechanized tractors with satellite guidance and remote control and so forth, so you need no labor power. And then you crop spray with Monsanto Roundup, and you create these huge poisonous concentrations of Monsanto soybeans across Argentina. That's what's been done. It destroyed one of the most beautiful family agriculture systems in the world, which was the case of Argentina back in the 70s, in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. Now, you do conclude the book by talking about, and of course you alluded to it earlier, that this issue, the agenda of population control. Could you help sort of seal that case? I mean,
sure.
It had its beginnings in eugenics, and now that we're seeing that move.
Well, many of the biggest investors in Monsanto, including the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which just bought millions of shares of Monsanto, are also some of the biggest advocates of population reduction. Bill Gates' father was a president of a eugenics organization, Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger's old organization, which is very close to the Rockefellers historically. That being neither here nor there, but the Gates Foundation is a major sponsor as well of bringing GMO into Africa under an organization headed up by Kofi Annan, the former United Nations Secretary General, project for a green revolution in Africa. And the green revolution they're talking about is nothing other than bringing patented seeds into traditional African agriculture and putting Africa, one of the most fertile lands on the planet that hasn't yet been destroyed from its soil nutrients and so forth by industrialized agriculture techniques, taking Africa and putting it under the thumb of U.S. agribusiness. And that would create an enormous power concentration. So the that's one aspect of it. The other is the role of the U.S. government in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which is an agency of the U.S. government, more or less run by agribusiness. No Secretary of Agriculture is approved in the Congress unless agribusiness behind the scenes gives them the green light or the thumbs up. And U.S. Department of Agriculture funded a project for creation with a company, a biotech company in San Diego, California, about a decade back, for creation of corn that was, and I pause and say this very slowly, spermicidal. And the president of that company, Episeed, actually gave a euphoric press conference before he was hushed up because it was a little bit too explosive politically. He gave a press conference and said, I have developed a solution to the world's overpopulation, namely spermicidal corn, genetically modified corn that kills human sperm when humans eat it. So that these are some of the indications. And I think it doesn't take a great stretch of the imagination to project, let's say, 10 to 20 years into the future when gradually the resistance, the political resistance in the European Union, already they've more or less bought the European commissioners to go for GMO, despite huge grassroots resistance across Europe. But Monsanto is determined to break the barrier in Europe and flood Europe with Monsanto patented seeds. Imagine that 10 years or 20 years down the road, China, Russia, India, and so are dominated by Monsanto-licensed GMO seeds or Syngenta or DuPont Dow Chemical, it doesn't matter, but it's all more or less functions as one cartel. The power that controls those seeds, the power that controls Monsanto, would then have the ability for the first time in history to cut off essential seeds for the further harvest, leaving aside all health dangers and so forth of GMO seeds and the chemicals that are paired with them. They would have such a power that no elite on Earth in human history has ever assembled, that kind of control over the food supply. Mm-hmm. So I think that it begins to suggest that we ought to be asking some of these kinds of questions in our public debate about GMO.
Well, William Engdahl, I want to really thank you for that analysis. It's definitely something that people should confront, given the importance of our food supply and maintaining some form of food sovereignty and control over what it is we put in our bellies and the way we do agriculture. So thank you very much for sharing those views with us.
Thank you.
And William Engdahl is the author of Seeds of Destruction, The Hidden Agenda of Genetic Manipulation, and the book is available for sale through the globalresearch.ca website. That was We Will Rock Monsanto by Oshawa-based musician Rob Fuller. Anyone wishing to participate in the worldwide October 12th actions against Monsanto should visit march-against-monsanto.com on the World Wide Web for information about events in your neighborhood. And that's our show for this week. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.